My name is Paul Slovic. I'm a professor at the University of Oregon and also a researcher at a private institute called Decision Research. And we study kind of the psychology of decision making, and it involves looking at how people use information when they have to make a judgment and decision. I'm a psychologist, but decision making is a multidisciplinary field, and one of the elements that we look at very closely is decision making in situations of risk and uncertainty.
The field of psychology, how well studied is the bystander phenomena?
There's a little work on bystanders in social psychology. It really has to do with incidents where people stand around while other people right in front of them are being harmed. So there's a social psychological literature attempting to understand that. What I'm trying to understand is more these state-supported mass abuses of human beings, and where you're not witnessing it directly, but you know about it, and the media are telling you, and individuals and their governments do nothing. Why is it that even though most people in the world think of themselves as good and compassionate and caring people and would work to help people around them who are in need, yet these same good people, when there are situations where large numbers of people are being harmed, basically these good people turn away and do little or nothing to help. So I'm interested in why that is. What are the psychological processes that lead good people to be apathetic or indifferent towards mass murder and genocide?
And what are those processes?
The problem seems to be basically the more who die, the less we care. That's what we can observe. In a country like the United States, we spend huge amounts of money to save a life in danger or to extend a person's life even by a little bit. So we value life very, very greatly. And yet when it's large numbers of lives, perhaps in another part of the world, we value those lives as almost worthless.
That is so paradoxical. How do you explain that?
I look at the way the human mind processes information, the way we think. And what we've learned through the psychological research is that that there are two forms of thinking. One is like intuition. It's kind of fast and automatic. It's very, it works through images and feelings and associations. We call it the experiential system. And we also, in our jargon, call it system one. System one is evolved in our brains, you know, at a much older time in our evolutionary history. It's how we dealt with risk, for example, risk from an animal lurking in the bushes, or is, you know, how we decided whether the water in the stream was safe to drink. We didn't do scientific analysis of the water like we do today. We said, well, how does it look? How does it smell? How does it taste? Did I get sick the last time I drank it? It's kind of experiential, perceptual knowledge and kind of automatic way to deal with it. And it contrasts with another way we can think, which is a more, you know, logical, reason-based, uses arguments, it uses mathematics, it uses, you know, it's science, it's analytic way of thinking. We call that system two. So we have these two ways of thinking, and our moral views also are linked to these. We can distinguish between moral intuition, which is this kind of fast, immediate judgment we make about something. You know, is that what that person is doing? Is it moral or immoral? Is it good or bad? Is it outrageous? It kind of just hits us. We just look at someone doing something. We say, that's terrible, or that's admirable. And then we also have moral judgment, which is more logical, thoughtful, you know, legal, you know, it's a more careful assessment. We have the capability of employing both moral intuition and moral judgment to evaluate mass murder. But we also know from science, scientific research, is that moral intuition dominates moral judgment. Our first response is the intuitive response. You know, how does it feel to us? Does it feel terrible? Does it make us angry? Does it make us sad? And often we just go with moral intuition as our compass, as our guide. And the problem with apathy towards mass murder and genocide is that when we let moral intuition run the show, our feelings are not sensitive to large-scale harms, to harms to many people, particularly at a distance. Our feeling system is designed to get us to react to things right around us. Few people, members of our family, our friends, our community, things that are right in our immediate environment, our immediate experience. That's what this system is really good at. So basically what the story is from my research is that people react strongly to one victim. They actually start to lose their ability to connect with a victim when you go from one to two. You know, not that it's gone, but we don't have as much sympathy or compassion for two victims as for one. If we start to lose it at two, well, no wonder it's gone at 200,000. And we can show that 200,000 to people is just a number. There's no feeling attached to it. I mean, it's just what we call a dry statistic. We say, you know, statistics are human beings with the tears dried off. So knowing that our minds work this way, that we're so easily distracted from these problems, then we have to create laws and institutions that won't be distracted. We thought we had it with the UN and Genocide Convention and some other rules and treaties that have been drafted. They're not working. You know, it's been over 60 years since the end of the Holocaust. There have been repeated instances around the world of mass murder and genocide. No adequate response to that. It goes on and on and on. The laws and institutions right now are not working. And what my research shows is our feelings, you know, the way we judge morality is not capable of dealing with this. So that's the challenge. Now that if we understand this, the psychology, we realize our feelings are going to let us down. They're going to deceive us. But if, if we also make the intellectual connection that this kind of behavior of mass abuse of human beings should not be tolerated in a civilized world, then we have to say, okay, so what? How do we stop it? And we now realize also that we don't yet have the means to stop it. International law and international institutions are not yet up to the job.
What could turn these institutions into effective means of stopping genocide?
As a psychologist, I have to be careful of not to go into realms of politics and law where I'm not adequately knowledgeable. But I've been thinking about that, and I've been talking to people. And one of the ideas we've been thinking about is to see if we can institute a requirement, even in the UN or within other governments, that you have to deliberate publicly when you're making a decision what to do about some case of mass murder or genocide. So that right now, if you decide to intervene, of course you have to say, okay, why are you intervening? Like even when our government in the United States decided to go into Iraq, we had to give a reason. They have weapons of mass destruction. It wasn't true, but that was the reason. We had to have a reason to go in there. But you don't have to have reasons not to go there. So we are making decisions not to do things, and we don't have to justify it. So what if you had to justify it? Why not, put into some laws or codes that when a case comes up, if you don't act, you need to explain why. And why would this be important? Well, I think it's very difficult to justify publicly not doing something to save lives that are in danger. For example, the UN commander in Rwanda, Romeo Dallaire, recounted some conversations he had with American officials and generals who told them that they didn't think it was worth losing the life of one American soldier to save, so many thousand Rwandans. But they didn't make that public. If they would have been forced to say, okay, we're not going into Rwanda, and here is why, if they knew that they had to justify it, I think they would have thought harder about turning their backs on Rwanda. So it's a very soft requirement. It's not as strong as redoing the UN, but it's a reasonable requirement. I mean, because inaction is a behavior, isn't it? And it should be justified just like action is justified. So my colleagues and I are going to propose that. Whether we'll get anywhere with it, I don't know. It's an idea, but it's an attempt to cope with the fact that the present system of laws and institutions is not working. We need to do something. Otherwise, we will be witness, we will be bystanders for another century of terrible atrocities. And I hope that that won't be the case.